Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, how Russians are reacting to their collapsing economy.
But first, to a seismic shift today in U.S.-Cuba relations.
In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
President Obama speaking earlier today, among the changes the U.S. will make to begin to normalize relations with Cuba, expanded banking, trade and travel, and opening a U.S. embassy in Havana. The president's announcement came after news that Cuba has released American Alan Gross, a contractor for USAID who had been in prison there for the past 5 years. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley joins us from Washington with more on this. And Scott, so much to go through here. Let's start with the embassy. The last U.S. embassy in Cuba closed in 1961. Now the White House says it wants to open one within the next few months.
Right. And of course, the embassy is just a symbol of those newly normalized relations with Cuba. And that is, as the president himself said, the biggest policy change in more than five decades. It's been 50 plus years of trying to freeze out Cuba in the name of bringing democracy and freedom to that island country. And it hasn't worked. Obama says time to try something different.
Well, one thing that they will be doing differently is a change in the travel policy, which is going to be relaxed even further. Tell us about that.
That's right. The administration had already eased some of the restrictions on travel and commerce with Cuba, making it easier, for example, for Cuban Americans to send money home to their families and for Americans in lots of different categories to visit Cuba. Now the White House is going to go further and just push those policies as far as they possibly can. Now, the embargo, the U.S. embargo on Cuba, will still be in effect. That's legislation, and that can't be actually lifted without an act of Congress. And the White House is frank in saying they don't anticipate any kind of act of Congress anytime soon. But in the meantime, they are going to push the limits of the law and make it even easier for more Americans to visit Cuba. The president said he thinks Americans themselves, American visitors, are the best ambassadors for our way of life and our values. And it'll be possible for Cuban Americans to send more money home. And those who do visit Cuba will be able to come back with more merchandise, including up to $100 worth of Cuban cigars for personal consumption.
All right. So the ban on importing Cuban cigars is over, but with some limits, it appears. Are there any other big policy changes we should know about?
Yes, there's a lot of big policy changes. And just to give you an idea of that, when the White House kind of gave a background session for reporters to talk about this, they had folks from the Commerce Department, from the Treasury Department, from the State Department. This will reach into lots of branches of the bureaucracy. And again, the real goal here is to push the executive powers as far as they can within the limits of the legislated embargo.
And President Raul Castro in Cuba spoke this afternoon. What did he have to say?
Well, Castro was somewhat conciliatory. He also stressed that this doesn't mean that the economic blockade that's been in place for five-plus decades is gone, and he called on America to lift that blockade. But he praised the president for taking the steps, and he also welcomed the release of some Cuban spies who'd been held in this country for many, many years.
Well, let's talk about that. This is the other big news of the day, the release of Alan Gross, as we said, who'd been in prison in Cuba for the last 5 years. He was working there as a contractor for USAID. How central was Alan Gross's release to these policy changes announced today?
It was really the linchpin. Obviously, this is a policy shift that the White House has wanted to take, that President Obama has wanted to take for many years. Even back when he was campaigning in 2007, 2008, remember, he said it's time to have more openness towards Cuba. Isolation is not working. But so long as Alan Gross, this contractor for USAID, was being held prisoner in Cuba, wrongly imprisoned in the eyes of the United States, it was really impossible for the U.S. to adopt this kind of change. So the release of Alan Gross on what the White House is calling humanitarian grounds cleared the way for these policy moves to go forward. And at the same time, there's this prisoner swap between both Cuban spies going back to Cuba and an important American intelligence asset, unnamed, but who was imprisoned in Cuba for close to 20 years, who's also been set free.
For 20 years, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about that in the coming days. And we should say, in the case of Alan Gross, it appears that Pope Francis was involved in that.
Well, I think Pope Francis actually played a significant role in this whole opening. Now, the U.S. and Cuba were already talking as far back as the spring of 2013. But when President Obama met with Pope Francis at the Vatican earlier this year, aides say the two men talked about Cuba as much as they talked about any other subject. And after that, Pope Francis wrote a personal appeal both to President Obama and to Raul Castro in Cuba, urging them to work together to end these decades of isolation. And the Vatican actually hosted the final face-to-face negotiating session earlier this fall. There had also been a number of in-person negotiations in Canada to facilitate this policy change.
And we're already hearing from Republicans who are not in favor of what the president is doing here. Scott, just give us a sense of the reaction from Republicans.
Well, Marco Rubio has been outspoken in opposition to this. But it's interesting. A poll taken in Florida earlier this year found majority support for this kind of policy. And even among Republicans, more people opposed this kind of more people favored this kind of opening than opposed it.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley with the latest on this momentous day in Washington and a major shift in policy towards Cuba. Scott, thanks.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
And to Russia now, where worries are rising as the country's currency, the ruble, sinks. It's now trading at about half the value it had at the start of the year, even though the Russian government tried to bolster it by increasing interest rates to 17% to make more money and by selling off a chunk of its much more valuable dollar reserves. President Putin is expected to hold a press conference tomorrow. Ahead of that, we wanted to see how Russians were reacting to all of this news. NPR's international correspondent Corey Flintoff is there. He's in Moscow. So, Corey, what are you seeing? What are people saying?
Well, as you just said, the currency has lost about half its value in the past year. And for ordinary people, that means that their savings, even their savings in rubles, have lost about half their value. And it's because of inflation. Prices have been rising really quickly. And it's something that people are aware of and remember. You know, from 1998, the ruble collapsed, absolutely collapsed then. And the Russian government went into default, essentially. It went bankrupt. People's savings were absolutely wiped out back then. And, you know, they had to just go into survival mode. And, you know, we talked to a number of people who are in their 40s and 50s who remember that very well. And, you know, they're preparing to hunker down for what they think are going to be very hard times.
We're seeing stories about people running out and buying washing machines, for instance, because they're afraid the things are going to skyrocket. What are you seeing?
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, for people that do have money, it makes more sense to go out and buy what we used to call durable goods, you know, things that, like refrigerators and TV sets. The idea is that, you know, you'll have more value out of a refrigerator than you because it won't lose value as fast as your rubles do.
Well, and how worried are people? This could, obviously, inflation is happening, but are they worried about the D word, depression?
It depends on who you talk to. One thing to remember is that Russia's official media are not giving this very much coverage. You know, the state television channels rarely talk about it, and when they do, they always cast it in the most positive possible light because they're afraid of triggering a panic. So a lot of people aren't that readily aware of what's going on, especially people outside the main population centers in places like Moscow and St. Petersburg. Among people that we've talked to that do know what's going on, though, they say that they're almost in shock. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing panic on the streets. We're not seeing people making runs against the banks. Another thing to remember, though, about Russia is that salaries are not that high and people don't have huge amounts of savings. That's why they're so dependent on pensions. One of the reasons why Vladimir Putin is so popular, because he guaranteed people that their pensions would be preserved, and he's actually raised pensions whenever possible. So people tend to believe that the government really can protect them from this, and they're waiting now to see what the government's going to do.
Well, we're talking to you to get the view of Russians on the ground, and in fact, we've reported on the economics of this. We'll link to that at hereandnow.org. But how are Russians feeling about Vladimir Putin? The sanctions that were put in place against Russia were because of Russians' actions in Ukraine, the seizing of Crimea, the backing of rebels fighting the government in Kiev. Russians supported that. How are they feeling now?
You know, I think nothing sums it up quite as well as some news that we had yesterday, which was that Vladimir Putin has been named Russia's Man of the Year for the 15th year in a row. It's based on a nationwide survey. You know, if people are angry at the government, they're basically looking at other targets. You know, one target right now is the central bank. Putin has been pretty Teflon-coated so far.
We'll see if that holds up. And in fact, tomorrow he's going to be speaking to the country. What do you think people want to hear from him?
I think people do want to hear some kind of reassurance that the government is going to do something about this. You know, it's very hard to see politically how he could back down on any of the things that the West wants to reduce the sanctions. So I think, you know, what people will look for instead is kind of palliative things, you know, promises that the economy is going to get better, maybe a little defiance. One of the things we've heard a lot about lately is the siege of Leningrad during World War II. People starved, basically, rather than give up. Although that seems quite extreme at the moment, there is a theme that's going around in Russia right now saying that we can withstand this no matter how bad it is.
Well, is there anything you can see on the part of the government? You say no panic on the part of the people, and they feel they will withstand it, but any whiff of panic on the part of government officials?
Yes, there is, as a matter of fact. And analysts have pointed out to me that we are hearing different factions in the Kremlin starting to point fingers at each other.
Well, and of course, we're mindful that the United States almost had a financial collapse a couple of years ago. There's a lot of finger pointing then as well. Completely different reasons, but worth noting. NPR international correspondent Corey Flintoff in Moscow. Thanks so much, Corey.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Robin.
The Federal Aviation Administration is expected in the next couple of weeks to release a new set of proposed rules to regulate commercial drones. But there's also a lot of growth in recreational drones, and hobbyists are snatching them up in retail stores across the country for the holidays. Seth Stevenson of Slate recently tried out a bunch of drones to find out which one would make the best gift. He's with us now. Hi, Seth.
Hi.
Well, first of all, let's start with the rules here. And what are they? It sounds like there's not a standard set of rules for drones, depending on where you are.
It's really confusing. Even the people close to the issue get a little bit confused about this. The basic guidelines for hobbyists are don't fly your drone above 400 feet. Don't fly it out of the line of your own sight. Don't fly anything over 55 pounds. Don't fly it within 5 miles of an airport without telling the control tower.
But do people actually have to obey those basic guidelines? You're saying there's probably not anybody who's going to enforce that.
It's hard to know who's going to enforce it and whether or not it can be enforced by the FAA. You know, in cities, when people have flown drones in crowded areas in cities, sometimes the police departments will arrest them for reckless endangerment. But that's not a specific drone category. You could get the same you could have the same violation if you'd thrown a Frisbee in Midtown Manhattan, I guess. So it's very confusing for the hobbyist who opens up a drone on Christmas morning to know what they can or can't do. But I would advise them to use a lot of common sense because these are dangerous machines.
Well, and in fact, as you write, in New Jersey, a property owner actually shot the drone down when it came onto his property.
There's been all sorts of incidents like that. You know, at a TGI Fridays in Brooklyn recently, they were doing a little promotional stunt with a drone that was hovering with mistletoe over couples, and the propeller chopped off the tip of a woman's nose. I mean, it's terrible. You know, there have been a lot of near misses with drones and commercial jetliners where the drones have come close to the jetliners, and it seems like, you know, we're playing with fire there. One could get sucked into a jet engine or something. So there's a lot of danger inherent in using these things.
Okay, well, All of that being said, you did try out some, and perhaps somebody might want to buy a drone for the holidays this year. What did you find? What's out there, and what's good and what's not good?
So the first one that I tried was the DJI Phantom drone, which is a very popular drone made by a Chinese company. A lot of times when you see pictures of drones in the news or in the newspaper, it'll be the DJI. It's got an iconic look. And it's a very capable drone. It can go high in the air. It's very responsive. It's got a great camera that you can make movies with. However, it's not, for me, the absolute easiest to use out of the box for an amateur who hasn't done a lot of piloting before. I took it out of the box, read the quick start guide, thought that would be enough since it was the quick start guide, and immediately crashed the thing all to bits and probably endangered some people near me, and I didn't feel good about that. So that drone is a little bit more heavy duty than I want it to be for someone who really just wants to open it up on Christmas Day and immediately start using it. If you want that, if you want your 11-year-old to go out in the backyard and have fun, you know, 10 minutes after you open the gift, I would recommend the Parrot AR Drone 2.0, which is slightly
which is actually cozy. A quadricopter, right? Basically, it's got four little helicopter propellers on it.
Correct. Both of these are quadricopters. But the Parrot one is a little bit gentler. It's got these foam propeller guards. The speeds are a little slower. And it just seems like a drone that's you're going to feel a little bit safer with in the backyard.
All right. Well, full disclosure, I have used one of those Parrot AR drones, and you control it with your iPad or your iPhone. You download an app, and it's got a camera on it. And it didn't work after, I would say, about a year after I first used it. The battery would last maybe 5 minutes.
Interesting. Well, that's good feedback for consumers to know. I only use these for a couple of weeks. But you did point out one advantage, I would say, of the Parrot as opposed to the DJI. The DJI has a camera mounted on, but then you have a memory card in that camera. With the Parrot drone, yeah, you don't need a bulky, fancy remote control with lots of joysticks. You just use your phone to operate it. And the video that it takes, it just sends straight to your phone. And there it is in your phone's photo app, and you have that video, and you can immediately start playing around with it and editing it. So I like that. But that is good to know about the battery. And I would say, in general, the battery life on these things is not terrific. They do really run down pretty quickly.
What about cost? How much do these things cost?
You know, sky's the limit. For the DJI drone, I think the one I got, top-of-the-line model, was something like $1,100 or $1,300. You can get a really small guy, a little guy that you could fly around your living room. Parrot makes another line called the Rolling Spider, and that one's more around, I'd say, the $120 price range. That's a little drone that you can fly around your living room, and it has little guards on it. It might be better for kids.
Are they easy to use? In my limited experience, again, with the Parrot AR drone, it takes a little while to get used to it, and if you crash it into something, you could damage it.
You absolutely can damage them. I really badly damaged the DJI drone when I crashed it into a building, actually, pretty fast. You know, these things can go like 25 or 30 miles an hour. They weigh as much as a steam iron. They're a few pounds. You've got to be careful. And that's why I say, you know, be careful with these things. Use common sense. I actually think we should regulate them the way we regulate, say, mopeds. Because if you have an 11-year-old flying a 10-pound thing around at 30 miles an hour in the air in a neighborhood, you can really do some damage. So be careful with it. And yes, if you crash them, you can break them. And I'll note that they often will include a bunch of extra propellers in the box, which suggests that they anticipate you are going to crash these and you are going to shear the propellers off or break some propellers.
Let me ask you one more question, Seth. Given all of your experience now and looking into these things, is it something that if somebody's just going to use it purely recreationally, that it would be interesting to them for longer than a couple of days? Or is it something that's just a kind of a novelty and it'll go into the closet after you use it a few times and you'll never take it back out again?
The thing that's going to make it lasting fun for you and your family is if you want to do stuff with the camera, if you want to film things, if you want to plan out shots you're going to take, or if you want to do fun videos, I think that'll make it sort of a lasting toy. If you're just going to kind of fly it around the yard, well, I don't know how long that's going to entertain you for. If you're doing the same tricks over and over again, you'd start to get the hang of that, and I'm not sure it would sustain your interest.
Do you have any sense of how many of these are going to be sold this year?
It seems like kajillions because, you know, if you type in, you know, I want for Christmas X, drones will come up quickly. All the reports are that this is going to be a very popular toy at Christmas. And that's why I think we need to be careful because we're going to have drones buzzing around, 11-year-olds flying drones all over the neighborhood Christmas morning and without a lot of supervision in all cases and without any regulation and a lot of inexperienced pilots out there.
Seth Stevenson, who writes for Slate, and he's been testing out a lot of drones that it sounds like many people are going to be giving away as gifts this holiday season. Seth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, the National Film Registry just released its annual list of notable works in American cinema. 25 films will be preserved in the Library of Congress for future generations. The list includes both underground indie films and some movies with big cult followings, like The Big Lebowski.
I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? His dudeness or El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Jeff Bridges there as the dude in the Coen Brothers' 1998 comedy. Other picks included Saving Private Ryan and one of my favorites, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Good advice. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory also made the list, starring the great Gene Wilder.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
You can see the full list of films from the National Film Registry at hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
We'll begin with a spin.
For more than a decade, federal education policies have pushed schools to get parents more involved so that their kids will do better academically. Well, in one Texas school district, that idea is taking a new form. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Houston Public Media's Laura Eisensee reports.
One by one, moms enter a classroom at Morales Elementary School in Pasadena, Texas, just a few miles southeast of Houston.
Hola, buenos días, pásale.
There's a pile of sugary Mexican pastries and a fresh pot of coffee brewing. These moms are here because they have big goals for their young children. Sara Prieto has two daughters. One's in fifth grade and the other's in third.
I want my daughters to go to college, not just stop at high school and work in McDonald's or Burger King. No, I want them to go to college and have a career. So I told myself, I'm going, because this is very important.
Prieto dropped out of high school in 10th grade. She returned to her native El Salvador, got pregnant, and never made it back to school. She's here to learn how she can help her daughters have a better education. But this isn't a class. It's a charla. That's the Spanish word for chat.
Like when you hang out with your friends here in America, you know, you invite them over on a Thursday night or a Friday night, and you just hang out in the garage and you barbecue.
That's Hortensia Melchor. She's the parent coordinator and counselor on campus.
And it's just feeling of you're surrounded with people that you trust, people that are going to give you advice when you need it.
That advice includes how to make reading a daily habit, how to ask for help on campus, and how to plan early for college. The Charla program is something that the Pasadena Independent School District is trying out this year. Assistant Superintendent Gloria Gallego says families need more support. More than 80% of her students are Hispanic and from low-income homes.
When you have 85% of our district population that it's economically disadvantaged, they bring with them greater needs. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to break the cycle of poverty by working on both the parents and the kids.
But getting parents involved in school doesn't always pay off as expected. That's according to one researcher at the University of Texas at Austin. Keith Robinson looked at different ways parents get involved and what that meant for their kids.
The general notion that kids do better in school when their parents are involved does not stack up. We found that most forms of parental involvement yield no benefit to children's test scores or grades, regardless of their racial and ethnic background or socioeconomic status.
Robinson also found that traditional activities like attending PTA meetings didn't help. But he says a few things can make a difference.
The list of what consistently works is very short, and that would be expecting your child to go to college, regularly discussing activities that your child engages in at school, and requesting a particular teacher for your child.
Robinson says overall schools should help parents find creative ways to communicate the value of education to their kids. Back at Morales Elementary, moms are watching a video. It's about how to make a family education plan.
afterwards, they start chatting. Sara Prieto says that conversation really helps.
Uno agarra ideas, tal vez no necesariamente del video, pero
you get ideas, not necessarily from the video, but from the other moms. Examples of how they did it with their older kids, and how we, who have younger ones, can motivate them so that they advance in school.
Prieto is also showing her daughters how much education means to her. She just finished a GED course to finally earn her high school diploma. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
In the October New Yorker, there's a fascinating account of a so-called kitchen network of Chinese undocumented immigrants serving takeout in Pennsylvania, working a buffet in Maryland. It's a real story that is writ large, writ beautifully, in Atticus Lish's new novel, Preparation for the Next Life. It's at heart a love story between Zhou Lei, an ethnic Uyghur immigrant from China working in Queens, New York, trying to keep afloat while staying below the radar and working a series of soul-killing jobs, and Skinner, a veteran of three tours in Iraq whose soul may already be gone. They talk, but mostly they walk. Atticus Lish walks too, and he taught for a while in China. He learned Mandarin as a kid. He served in the military. He's the son of Gordon Lish, the fabled editor who worked with Raymond Carver. But Atticus Lish never thought he could write a book. Now he's crafted what Dwight Garner of the New York Times calls a novel unlike any other in its intricate comprehension of and deep feeling for life at the margins. And Atticus Lish joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you so very much for that.
We hear both of their inner lives, both of these characters, one desperately trying to succeed. She's the hardest worker you've ever met. The other desperately trying to keep his eyes open. He's so medicated. But they really do become our eyes walking constantly through these neighborhoods. I know you have a little bit of a reading there. Can you, this is Zhou Lei, who's just walking. Can you read a little bit of what she sees and therefore what, as readers, we see?
Further on, the sounds of deep music came from behind the houses, from what sounded like a well hidden behind abandoned and burned out squats, mattresses and sofas in piles of trash next to dark porches you were afraid to look upon. There were no more city blocks. It just went on and on. As she cleared the corners of buildings, she saw scenes in the trees behind them, distant, silent figures in white shirts milling around a car with all the doors open. There was the sense of strangers who lived among each other, robbing each other, predicting who would be robbed next. The road ran by a park area that was dead gray in the dull light, and the houses behind it were utterly silent. Hmm.
Do I understand that you made these walks? I mean, first of all, for non-New Yorkers, describe where she is and how vast this area is that many of the people in New York just drive over on their way to Long Island.
If you get off the train at Ozone Park on the A train and you walk down Liberty Avenue, you just keep going and you get towards 109th Street and Rockaway. Then I went north on, I want to say, Monroe Street, crossed Hillside Avenue, and then went as far east as starting to be Long Island at that point, and then up
Port Washington, Northern Boulevard.
Yeah, to what is it, Little Neck, Great Neck?
Right.
It would be Great Neck, I guess. Yeah, Douglaston. So that was the loop. I think it's about 40 miles.
I was going to say that's an amazing amount of walking.
It's a lot of walking, I know.
It assaults you with, first, huge graffiti that, as you say, lumbers along like elephants, and then lawns, but in between really scary spaces. Like, what was that like?
That part that you just had me read, I actually was concerned at that point. But mainly I wasn't concerned for my safety. It was mainly interesting. You see an evolution as you walk. Walking, I've always related it to writing and reading a book. I was reading a lot of Hemingway for a while, and Hemingway would describe these hunts in the green hills of Africa. He would talk about he would be walking too. And so I think that wrapped up itself up in my mind with going on a long journey. And that's why I ended up taking a lot of these walks. My wife took them with me, too, a lot of the time. You know, we walked from Connecticut back to Grand Central Station one
day. What?
That's why Bridgeport is in the book. Bridgeport is in the first line of the book. And the reason Bridgeport got in my mind is because one day my wife and I just took the Metro North up to Bridgeport, Connecticut, and jumped off. And then we walked all the way back
It took us 24 hours. We walked back to Grand Central Station.
But, yeah. You know, to explain to people, it's hard to even do that. There's bridges. You know, there's water that you have to cross. There's a lot of it is industrial. Yeah. Why do it?
I think I was a little bit fascinated with where you see New York City kind of taper out or grade out into the rest of the world. I thought, well, let's see what's next to what. You know, I mean, you might be in this area that you call home. Let's see what's over the next hill. And then let's see where it turns into Long Island and where Long Island turns into the countryside. I mean, I just – that transition between urban and rural is interesting. And there's a larger theme for me, which is how a lot of our ghettos have people who are rural in them. A lot of people from the third world who wind up living in depressed circumstances here in a real urban environment, they're coming from the country. And that countryside to urban movement is there's something about it. I guess because when you're in the country, you bring knowledge of the earth or something with you. And it's right here in the city.
In reading this, there's something thrilling about suddenly being taken through these neighborhoods. I remember as a child, I wanted to get down off the Long Island Expressway and see where the Dugan trucks were. You know, they're parked
the
Dugan
there. Dugan trucks.
Oh, Dugan. They delivered pastries and stuff, you know, and you could see that they were all parked in this sort of industrial area. And it sounds like she walked through things like that. Your character walked through things like that. But the difference is that you can do it to see what's thrilling. Your character is kind of trapped there.
That's right. My stuff is really neither here nor there. This is just what went into trying to create an experience for the reader. Yes. Yeah.
Did you feel that, though, at times? Did you, you know, try to imagine how a young Chinese woman would feel just walking and walking with no papers, no identity, no real grasp of the language?
Well, definitely when working on that scene, I tried to get the whole book to come to the point where in this scene, all the doors are closing for her. And that was how I had imagined it from the outset. I wanted to create a situation where there was very few ways out for somebody.
Hmm. Atticus Lish, the book is Preparation for the Next Life. And by the way, that comes from a saying over a mosque that your young Uyghur Chinese worker enters. Preparation for the Next Life?
It sort of sums up everything that the book is really about to me, because Zole wants to put together a life. She meets Skinner and she's in love with him, and she wants to for them both to work and to get healthy and to build a life together. So that's what she's struggling to do, and there are many obstacles to that because she doesn't have papers. She could get deported at any time, and Skinner's falling apart. For Skinner, it's his next life after combat. And the next life also refers to the afterlife. There's an element of menace when you say that, or if you may not be able to do it in the actual life.
Yeah. Atticus Lish, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and if you've just joined us, we just spoke with Atticus Lish. His acclaimed new novel is Preparation for the Next Life. The heroine, Zole, is an undocumented Uyghur from China who waits on New York street corners for a van that will take her to a Motel 6, where she'll share a room with six other Chinese women and then work at Chinese take-up places during the day. Disdained by other Chinese workers from other regions, she can't understand their dialects or English. There are more than 40,000 Chinese restaurants across the country, nearly three times the number of McDonald's, including restaurants in tiny Pinedale, Wyoming, Old Forge, New York. There are three in Belle Vernon, Pennsylvania, which only has about 1,000 residents. It's a world that was profiled in a recent New Yorker article by Lauren Hilgers called The Kitchen Network, in which real workers, like the fictional Zole, travel from villages in China to these Chinese restaurants. We want to find out more, so we're joined by a professor who contributed to that New Yorker article, Peter Kwong, professor of immigration and Asian American studies at Hunter College. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
And can you give us some of the history of this? We're reading in The New Yorker about a young man who paid $70,000 to what he called a snakehead, somebody who would help him come to the United States. How long has that kind of emigration been going on?
The immigration of that type, illegal immigration coming from China, mainly since the late 1980s, that is after United States and China normalized relationship, and working class poor people coming from mainly at that point coming from Fujian province. And so we noticed them since 1988 onward.
Well, and we're reading that in some cases this immigration was so sudden that entire villages in Fujian would just empty out overnight.
That's right. So what happened is that first people coming in and found possibilities in employment, particularly in New York region, because they are a large labor market, and they start helping their relatives coming in. And pretty soon the words get around, you could make a lot of money. And all the male, mostly male, began to leave the village. As a result, you have many, many villages, literally, that we've seen, just empty out all its mail.
Although they might empty out of residents, but they started then perversely a few years later to fill up with huge McMansions. We understand some of them empty because these workers, and we'll talk about the work that they were doing, but these workers started to send money back.
That's right. So in Chinese family structure is that everybody who, even if you leave, you're part of the family. So therefore, they still see themselves having a home. And then when they make money, they want to show off, make their relatives at home feel better. They will give money and build mansions, even though they have never had the opportunity to go back for most of them.
The New Yorker reporter Lauren Hilgers goes to a village in Fujian province, and she sees all these empty McMansions, and someone says to her, oh, that's okay. Even if it's boarded up, it's okay because someone will look at that and say that person's doing really well in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. That's why also pushes everybody out. The mansions is a way to show that they're doing fine and you should join them.
Well, but let's talk about how they are doing. This, you know, so-called kitchen network in the U.S. Mm-hmm. that these immigrants, after having paid this extraordinary amount of money and being picked up and ferried from China through sometimes other Asian countries, then to Mexico, where they're smuggled across the Rio Grande, and many end up in New York, where they go to these employment agencies who then ferry them out again. Where do they go?
Initially, in the 80s, they're not that many Chinese restaurants. But as these illegals coming in larger and larger number, restaurants began to appear in the suburbs and then farther and farther away. By now, almost every town across the country, they're either takeout or Chinese restaurant or buffet. Mm-hmm. So that's the pattern of growth fueled by the number of people continue to come in looking for jobs, and the availability of jobs created by the fact that many early immigrants, they make enough money and started to open up their own restaurants.
Well, and so what do these workers do? Atticus Lish writes about a young woman who's, you know, again, put on a van and driven sometimes out of New York. She might work for a month outside of New York City. She doesn't speak the language, so when she runs into any kind of trouble, including, you know, violence potentially, she feels she can't go for help. Describe the life that these workers have.
Normally, they will be living in a dorm situation, often supplied by the employers. And they will be living usually in a very, very isolated neighborhoods. And since they don't speak English and they hardly venture out of the environment. And what they usually make are very, very low wages, although living and food situation is taken care of. So they do save as much as they can.
Well, they make very little, maybe 1,000, 2,000 tops a month, something like that. But isn't that extraordinary compared to people in China who might make 4,000 a year?
Exactly. So therefore, that income contrast make them think that the United States is a much better place. After all, you could save $70,000 to pay off your debts in about 3 or 4 years. That's a lot of money.
Well, but Professor, someone like you, a scholar, and yes, other Chinese looking at this, your thoughts on this system, is it abusive as it seems to be in Atticus Lish's book where this young Uyghur woman is abused by the other Chinese who come from different regions who look down on her as a Uyghur? In the New Yorker article, we read about workers who say, you do this job too long, you'll lose your mind. You don't have your family there. You're isolated. You don't meet other people. You might go to 20 different restaurants in different states in 1 month, traveling around on buses. You have no real place to live. Is this the typical immigrant story where this is going to be worth it for this generation because they say they're just doing it to make life better for the children they might have? Or is this a trap? Are they trapped here?
The problem here is that's how America is built. You constantly try to take advantage of new immigrants willing to work with a lot of reasons to work hard. So these people are working numb. They don't have time to have any kind of enjoyment.
Working numb? Did you say numb?
Yes. Mm-hmm. To the point that, it is true that it's very bleak. The trade-off, of course, is that the hope that they will save enough money, pay off the debts, and even more, they could start on their own restaurants or, enough money to have children that they will be able to go to college. So that's a typical American immigrant story. Nevertheless, it is very harsh, very exploitative, and potentially abusive. And so the kind of story that in the novel is quite true. So there have been many pushbacks, although usually in larger cities, in New York City, for instance, many labor strike against these kind of practices. But when you're in a suburb or in far away in countryside, that fighting back is not easy. That's why a lot of them ending up quitting, because they can't stand the abusive situation. They decide they're going to go back to New York and go back to employment agents, get a better job.
Yeah.
And usually it's not that much better.
Well, having read Atticus Lish's terrific new book, Preparation for the Next Life, and speaking to you, one thing is true, Professor. You will never look at the person who hands you your takeout the same way again. That's Peter Kwong, Professor of Immigration and Asian American Studies at Hunter College in New York. Professor, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.